Okay, but these evenings it's nice even to sit outside. You can hear well outside as well as inside. So for this evening's talk, another request made online. This one was from a person in the UK. And it's quite a moving little story of someone who was not wanted as a child, an unwanted birth, and parents splitting up, and just, again, just being told to feel that they were just an obstacle to their parents' freedom and happiness, and always feeling this sense of lack of worth, rejection, from the earliest times in their life. And as a result of that, you know, never really doing well at school, never doing well in relationships, simply because one felt one wasn't worth anything. And because of that, that it was reinforcing their sense of failure in life, and being someone who was just so low and worthless, that it was so hard to actually to prove otherwise once you get into that cycle. So they wanted me to talk this evening. How do you deal with such people if you come across them, or if you're one of those yourself? From the earliest moments in this life, you've been told that, you know, you're just an obstacle to other people's happiness. You are worthless. You're actually worse than worthless. You're just a burden on other people. And of course, you know that many people who have that very strong, imposed lack of self-worth eventually not only just become failures in life, but tend to self-harm, get into addictions and suicide, or they even do worse and harm other people. So it's all about how to deal with rejection and this very deep sense of lack of self-worth, which is imposed upon us, sometimes by others. And you know, the first thing which, you know, I always reflect upon is that you're not just conditioned by your genes or by your upbringing. You're much older than this life. You know, in Buddhism, we accept as an absolute, as a truth, as a provable idea that, you know, we have many lives. And when a person comes into this life, they come with a lot of history. Unfortunately, it's buried deep inside of them. I'm not going to go on to the proof of reincarnation or rebirth. That was focused on, I think, last week by Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Bamali's early Buddhism course, which I think should be online now. But, you know, there's so much evidence for that. But what it means is, if you're a person who comes into this life and had a very, very hard beginning to your life, or even up to now, remember, you're much more than this life. Deep underneath there is this other being, which has been covered up, you know, just by the trauma of your early life and thinking you're not worth anything. And because there is something more inside of you than just that, that is something which, as a Buddhist monk, I want to try and awaken a person to. They're much more than the abuse they have suffered. They have a much longer history than that. In Mahayana Buddhism, which we accept as well as Theravada Buddhists, we have all these different types of Buddhism, but you know, they're all, as I keep on saying, the same cake with different icing on the outside. But they always used to emphasize the point that every human being has what they call Buddha nature. It's quite a beautiful idea. It means that you have the various highest, the most perfect, beautiful compassion, kindness, purity, love, truth within every human being. And it's something which, you know, I took on board a long time ago. So, you know, when I do go to prisons, or I do go to places like the Franklin Center to see people who are going through a very, very tough emotional time, and, you know, some of the locked wards because they have mental disabilities or mental disturbances, to see even in all those people there's the Buddha nature inside. There's this beautiful heart of peace and wonderful kindness and inside of them. And the results are really quite fantastic. You know, if I go into a prison and see a murderer, I see a paedophile, and I'm going to say that that's not what I see there, but see what other people say, these terrible people. And you look deeper inside of that terrible thing which has happened to them, or why they did those things. You see that deep inside of them they've got this incredible, beautiful heart. You've all probably heard stories of some of these monsters and gorillas who can be just so kind and gentle. And it sometimes, why, is that the person who was in the newspapers who did all these terrible things? Yes, it is. There's another part to them, which is again why I keep on saying there's no such thing as a prisoner, there's no such thing as a murderer, there's only people who have murdered, people who have done those bad things. There's something more to them, deeper inside of them. But it's how to get a person to recognize that, you know, deep inside of them there is a beautiful part to them. And it doesn't really matter what other people have said to them or done to them. And believing such stuff is nowhere near as powerful as seeing for yourself what's really in the center of you. And a long time ago I developed a simile which can really help here. It was a simile of the lotus flower. It's a very old simile of a Buddha. And that's why we do have many lotuses on symbols of Buddhism. And the first simile of the lotus is a simile that a lotus is born in the mud, in the dirt on the bottom of a lake or a pond. And it's really yucky under there, and it's very dark and very cold. And that's where a lotus is born. Now, in the terrible times of your early life, it can be cold, rejected, hurt, even abused. But a lotus can grow in that stuff, in that muck. And it pushes itself up. What does it push itself up towards? To the warmth and the light, which you can sometimes sense at the top of the pond. And sometimes it just takes more than just one life to actually to reach past the top of the pond into the warm light outside of the water. But many lotuses actually do that. The Buddha said it's born in the mucky stuff, but it pushes itself always towards the top, towards the light, and eventually breaks through and opens up into this gorgeous lotus you see in the lakes and the ponds, even in our cities. There's a very beautiful simile which says that even though you're born in yucky stuff, you can actually grow right through that. And it's a tendency of human beings always to grow towards the light, to the warmth, to get out of the cold, yucky, dark, gloomy stuff. And that will always be the tendency for all people, no matter how they are born. Sometimes, it's like they're being born under a rock and they can't push through it, but you do with a bit of help. But the other simile is one of the more powerful ones about the nature of the human being. And that was the simile of the thousand petal lotus. I usually just use this for meditation practices, but it's appropriate here. Because if ever you see a lotus at night time, the lotus is always closed up. And if ever you look at a lotus flower when it's closed up at night time, no one would ever expect that in that dark, in that dirty, dusty, serrated, unfragrant, unbeautiful exterior, could be these incredibly fragrant, beautiful petals inside. Because the lotus is closed up. And of course, that is my simile for people who are all closed up. And all you see on the outside of them is their rough edges, their negativity, their darkness, their pain. That's on the outside. Because it's the outside petals which have to take, the experiences of life. But deep inside every lotus, there is the most beautiful and fragrant of petals inside. You know that with a lotus, and that's the same with human beings. It doesn't matter just how much you've been hurt in the past. It doesn't matter how much you've been told you're not worth anything. And you look at your closed lotus and you agree with them, you aren't worth anything. But look, inside of every human being, I'm talking about every human being, there's this beautiful part inside. Our job is how to actually open that up. So we can see for ourselves, rather than just believing what others tell us, who we are and what we are. And that is the path of a little bit of mindfulness, a little bit of kindness. Because in the simile of the lotus, it's closed up at night time, in the early morning when the first rays of the sun hit the outermost petal of the lotus, it is the light and the warmth of the sun which opens up the outermost petal. And that allows the light and the warmth to hit the next layer of petals, and the next layer of petals as they open up in turn. And the deeper that the petals open up, the more fragrant, the more beautiful, the more refined are those petals. The really gorgeous ones are right in the middle there. And so it is the job to actually open up a human being. So they can see for themselves, despite what your parents may have said, your teachers may have said, your case officers may have said, there's an incredibly beautiful person inside there. It's just opening it up so you can see it for yourself, so you don't just have to believe me. And to be able to do that is, you know, some of the purpose of our spiritual life. How do we actually do that? How can we open up? How can we actually allow the light of the sun and the warmth of the sun to open us up? And of course, the light, that represents awareness, mindfulness. And the warmth of the sun represents kindness, compassion. That is actually what opens us up. We are become aware. It's a really great courageous thing to be aware, to be mindful. Because when we first become mindful, we're not really all that happy with what we feel. When I become mindful, when I sit here, I'm aware of this old, tired body. I'm getting old now. And as you get old, there's more aches and pains. And so as soon as I stop rushing around and can sit still, what am I aware of? This yucky feeling in my body. But I am kind enough and wise enough just to stay with it. Because there's a wonderful thing happens with awareness when you have kindness. When you're aware of even a pain in the body, too hot, too cold, it's been very not very nice temperatures. I don't know about where you are, but in Serpentine it's been very uncomfortable weather the last few days here. But what do? With it? You stay with it, you're aware of it, it changes. Because when you're aware of something and you stay with it, it actually softens up and it becomes much more comfortable. The problem with doing any awareness training is you don't stay there long enough to allow it to work. It's not something which will work straight away. You've got to stay with it, and sooner or later the mindfulness becomes aware of something really quite pleasant. So to be aware of those feelings of lack of worth, of feelings of rejection, feelings that you are worthless, be aware of it. Don't run away from it, for goodness sake. And number two, please have some kindness as well, which is probably the hardest thing which for people to learn. Awareness, mindfulness is not a hard thing to learn these days, but kindness, incredibly, is the most difficult part of the equation to open up the lotus and to see what a beautiful person you are inside. It's the warmth of the sun which is necessary. And to get that warmth to open yourselves up, if you don't receive it from other human beings, because we're not good at being kind towards one another, even family members, you would think family members, brothers and sisters, would learn how to be kind to each other. But you just remember at Christmas time, when you go home, I remember going to visit my family at Christmas a long time ago. And they were just so kind to each other when they went to visit each other for about 5 minutes. Oh, nice to see you. How have you been? And then the argument started. I mean, you're family members. Can't you be kind to one another and let each other be over Christmas time or Chinese New Year or whatever? Just learn how to be kind to one another. And how do you do that? At least speaking kind, looking kind, feeling kind, being kind. And that just softens all of the negativity and the bad speech, which is hard for people to do. So we do need examples of kindness, so we can actually grow in simple things like loving kindness. And you know, one of the easiest ways to learn loving kindness is to get a little pet. Because I read it in the newspaper in the local West Australian that some really smart person here in this state, there are some smart people in government, rare, but there are some, decided to take some of these juvenile offenders who got into all sorts of trouble with the law, instead of banging them up in a jail again or giving them counsellors, because sometimes the counsellors can't do anything either. Instead, they gave them dogs. They assigned every one of these really bad juvenile offenders a little puppy to look after, to train. And the results were incredible. And they were saying, instead of a counselor, another human being, yeah, they've been there, they've done that. And they went to to their little puppy, a little dog, to train and to get to know. And every time they went to this session with their puppy, the puppy would jump all over them and lick them. No counselor ever does that. Not even a monk does that. I'm not going to lick you. But These dogs would do that, and that just melted some of these really repeated offenders. And they were just only 16 or 17 and gone through just a lot of therapies, and that really got to them. Something was giving them unconditional love. And of course, you know, the puppy can't talk to you, but it does actually show you there was something inside of them, that this little juvenile offender had somebody who really cared about them and loved them, and that started opening them up. You know, sometimes you think, oh gee, I mean, having puppies and dogs, can't we have someone who's, you know, can actually talk to us? And I told on the retreat that when the monks from this tradition first went to England, you know, the people there were a bit concerned. I mean, can we, this was in the early days when there wasn't so many supporters. Now, can we afford to look after a monk? You know, how much does it cost to look after a monk? And it was this guy, he became the head of this trust which looked after our monastery in England. He was an economist, and he was actually on the board of the Bank of England. He was a professor at one of the universities in England. So, you know, he really knew his stuff about economics. So he decided to work out, before they invited any monks to their place, how much does it cost to look after a monk? And surprise, surprise, he found out that it's much cheaper to look after a monk or a nun than to look after a dog. Dogs are far more expensive. And so that when he found that out, to his surprise, and there's lots of similarities as well when you think about it, because, you know, the dogs live in little huts. We live in little huts, not dog houses, but monk houses called cooties. And the dogs eat out of a little bowl, just like the monks eat out of a bowl. And we're always very friendly. And actually, on Saturday morning, people take us out for a walk. It's called arms round. And we always, if we had tails, we'd always be wagging them, because we're very happy. And we're really sort of cuddly. You know, sometimes people want to pat you on the head. Nice, Ajahn. And we, no. There's lots of similarities there. Nice, soft, cuddly. But please don't cuddle me. No monks and nuns. But, you know, because we don't have that many, you know, you can't go and buy one from the Buddhist Society so every home can have one. I'm sure it would be very good sales if we could have monk shops, have little monks there, so you can just go and buy one, you know, when you feel a bit sad, and just take them for a walk every morning. Give them one feed a day, and they're always there for you, you know, to make you feel happy whenever you feel down. It'd be a great idea. However, there's not enough of us around for that, so you have to put up with dogs and cats. A bit more expensive, you know, not maybe as wise, but they've got unconditional love for you. What it actually does, it just starts to open up your heart. And it's the warmth of the sun starts to open up these kids. You know, they've had a very, very hard life and have started to offend. And why do people offend? Everybody, every psychologist knows they've got lack of self-worth. They don't think they're worth sort of being good people. And a little dog or a cat changes all of that. They feel for the first time love from somebody else. And that's all you need. When you see it from somebody else, you see it inside of yourself. That is why, you know, just going to prison, seeing the Buddha nature inside somebody, you know, this, I'm like a little dog, sees something, unconditional love towards these monsters, which, well, other people think are monsters. I see unconditional love. And if you're a dog, you don't care what crime your owner has committed. You don't care, you know, just their reputation in life. You just flick them like hell. And you jump all over them. Because you've got this beautiful, unconditional love. And that opens people up. Which is one of the reasons why this person in UK who asked me this question, if you really do feel you have a lack of self-worth and you're not worth anything at all, you're like a little ant who deserves to be squashed. I think that's the word which she used. And everyone else is putting you down in this world. And if you can't get to decent people who are wise enough to give you that unconditional love, just get it from a pet, especially a little dog, and learn unconditional love from one of the experts in our world. And just that will sort of start to open you up. You find a dog loves you and is kind to you. And from that, you say, why is it that this dog actually likes me? There must be something that dog can see in you, which is lovable. They can see that little Buddha nature inside. It softens you. And then you can start to look inside yourself. One of the other little practices which I ask people to do, if you think you're hopeless, no worth, no self-esteem at all, is actually to get the piece of paper out. I don't know how many times I've done this with a person, and just big piece of paper lying down the middle, your name on the top, and then just to get people going, okay, why don't you like yourself? What's wrong with you? And they put that down on the left-hand side of the line. And they do that. And they do that so quickly. And then once they finish that up, I ask them, okay, right-hand side of the line, write something beautiful about yourself. Something which you've done which is kind. You know, sometimes I've sat next to them, I've had to help them. They can't think of anything which is good about themselves. And so I just ask them questions, you know, did you pat a dog today? Did you give some water to the birds? Or there's a little, beautiful little wild rabbit at our Jhana Grove Retreat Center turned up a few days ago. And one of the Anagarikas, you know, had broken a little precept. And he's really upset about himself. And so I said, I'll give you a penance. What's a penance? What do I have to do? And so there's a hungry rabbit over in Jhana Grove. Go and take a carrot from the kitchen and go and give it to the rabbit. It's a wonderful little thing. A little wild rabbit is just hiding there because it's really hot in the forest. And then next to the wall by the Japanese garden, those of you who know Jhana Grove, he's just been hanging out there to get away from the heat of the forest. And so you just go up to him and just give him a carrot. And it's just so cute. And you know, even if you're a multiple murderer, it will soften you. Just see a little rabbit just twitching its little face and smelling the rabbit and then really getting into it. And apparently it eats it really fast. It's a very guzzly rabbit. But anyway, it's just beautiful to be able to feed it. And that makes you really soft. It makes you not to be so negative towards yourself. So a little bit of kindness with a rabbit, you know, with a dog or something, it just starts to open your heart up. And then you can write that down on the right-hand side. Yeah, I gave a carrot to a rabbit today. And it's a strange thing, which may be, you know, not strange for you because you can understand these things, but for others it's a strange thing. But once they get the first thing down, the second thing is much easier. Some other little good thing, kind thing they did. And the next thing, and the next thing, and they can actually soon fill up the right side of the paper. And the next thing which you do is to tear the paper in half along the middle line. You throw all the bad stuff away. That belongs in the trash can. And you keep the right-hand side. All of your good qualities, which somehow or another, you know, you've managed to open up to. And you keep looking at that. You realize you're not such a bad person. In fact, you're really quite good. You've got some kind qualities. And once you keep thinking about those kind qualities, they tend to grow. And you become a kinder, more compassionate, spending more time with other people. Other people start to like you, and you can't believe it. What? They like me? It's a strange thing, like being a monk, especially the young monks here. Sometimes that they think, oh, Ajahn Brahm, he's so wise, he's been a monk for 40 years, but me, I don't know nothing. But we have this little ways of even bringing up their confidence. They know a lot about Buddhism. They know a lot about Dhamma. They've been trained by me. They've been brainwashed by me. They know a lot. And so we have this youth group every Saturday evening, the Kalyanamitta group. Yeah, of course, I could go to that group and teach them, but that's missing out. I get the younger monks, push them in there. And then afterwards, they come back and they think, wow, people actually enjoyed what I said. They actually thought I was wise. And you know, that's a mind-blowing for some of the young monks. What? I was wise? Because a lot of us, you know, we always have this, again, this lack of self-esteem. Somehow or other, and this is ordinary people, not the people who have really been through hell and managed to survive somehow and hasn't come out with this really bad idea. Just most people just totally undersell themselves. And they don't think they are good enough. Look, I have these great little stories. And sometimes, why aren't you good enough? Who says you're not good enough? That's why I'm really against all these self-improvement courses. When I taught a retreat recently over at Jhana Grove, I said, this is not anything to do with self-improvement. Who said you're not good enough? You don't need to be improved. You're good enough as you are. So if anybody sort of signs you up for some self-improvement course, just throw it back at them. Who are you to say I'm not good enough? I'm good enough as I am. And that's it. I don't need to be improved. And you know you don't. Can you believe that? Can you accept that? If you can, I mean, you're on the way to enlightenment. But a lot of us think, no, I've got to fix up things first of all. I'm terrible. And that is not the way to have peace of mind, compassion. That's not the way to open up the lotus, try to fix yourself up. Your lotus opens up through awareness, not criticism, but kindness, compassion, allowing yourself to be who you are, no matter what that is. That gives you the confidence. And the confidence starts to open up really deep down inside of yourself. It's one of the reasons why that, you know, there's far too much criticism in our world. And please, don't be one of those people who criticizes. Be one of those ones who praises. Now, take your children, for example. Don't you bring up children like the person who wrote to me from UK, always putting down your kids. You're not good enough. You're in my way. And I've got work to do. I can't spend time with you. Please. Give your kids some confidence in their life. Give them time. Give them compassion. Always be pleased to see them. If you're a father or a mother, pretend you're the dog. As soon as you see your kid, wag your tail. Lick them. Oh, no, don't you know, kid, I'm busy. Get out. Do your homework. Watch the TV. Whatever it is, because if you don't show that kindness and love to your kid, of course, the kid thinks they're not worth anything, that your work is worth much more. And if they don't do well at school, and you still keep telling them off for not doing well at school, what type of kid are you creating? You don't have to do well at school. And one of the cases in point, which I love bringing up, again, usually only on retreats, there was one of my favorite monks in Thailand, a long time ago. I only heard about him when I was a young monk. I never actually met him, but the reason why I was impressed by him was his story, how he became a monk and how he became fully enlightened. Because he was a young kid when he went to grade one in school in the northeast of Thailand. It was only basic education, only 4 years of school. This was over 40, 50 years ago. Only 4 years at school, and then you were out in the fields plowing and doing stuff with your father and mother as subsistence economy. So when he went to grade one at school, after finishing the year, his teacher said, I'm sorry, I can't pass you. You can't go on to grade two. You have to repeat grade one. I don't know how anyone could fail grade one at school. You know, maybe plasticine, you can't do plasticine. I don't know what you do. How can you fail grade one? But this kid was so stupid, he failed grade one and had to repeat it. Well, all his friends went on to grade two. And after another year in grade one, his teacher said, look, I'm sorry, this was the best one in the world. You have to repeat it for a third year. And after 3 years of repeating grade one at school, the teacher, the headmaster again, sorry, we can't pass this kid. He's that stupid. And anyone who can't pass grade one after three tries, it's a waste of time sort of, you know, getting him to help plow the fields. It doesn't know one end of a water buffalo from another end. And so the only place they could send him, this was in Thailand in those times, if you were that stupid, you can't pass grade one after 3 years, was to send him to the monastery and make him a novice monk. Now, not all novice monks start their life out like that. And the reason they sent him to the monastery, the village monastery, because that was the sakatra, that was a social safety net. And at least the head monk in these monasteries are always incredibly kind and so patient, much more patient, you know, than any sort of teacher in a school. So this head monk in this monastery took this young kid under his wing and tried as much as he could to train him. Now, we have to do some sort of chanting, you know, as a Buddhist monk. And he tried to teach him how to chant simple things like the Namo Tassa. And so you get the first word, Namo. Yeah, what's the second word? Tassa. Oh, yeah, Tassa. What's the first word again? He was just so dumb, he could not even do Namo Tassa. And after a couple of years in the monastery, in the village, even the abbot just could not teach him. So the last resort, the final resting place of such hopeless little kids, were the forest monasteries, where I come from. So they sent him to one of these forest monasteries where you don't have to do the chanting and you just meditate all day. And this fellow, his mind was so simple. They just asked him, just, you know, just to watch your breath go in and out. And he could do it with no problem at all because, you know, he didn't think that much. Not like you guys. And so this person, which everyone thought was stupid, he got into the deep meditations really quickly and very quickly became fully enlightened, an arahat. So you say, who's the stupid one? Not this guy. His mind was so peaceful and so pure and kind. Interestingly, I remember the story, they said, well, you know, as a monk, he has to do some chanting, and he could chant very well after that experience, because what he actually did, so he said, that, you know, with a powerful mind like that, he could remember his past lives, remember the past life when he was a monk before, and when he actually did learn the chanting, and he would actually connect with that past life whenever he had to do the chanting. So, you know, he's actually sent his memory back. And that's why he could chant in this life. But in this life, his mind was so simple, he could hardly remember anything. And the reason I tell that story is, how can you judge a person? There was a person, school judged to be like mentally deficient, but when he found his niche in life, he became this incredibly powerful, wise, great meditating teacher. So, lack of self-esteem is just we haven't found our niche in life. And everyone has got this beautiful character inside of them. Just need to be opened up. He opened up because he was sent to the right place, the forest monastery, where he could actually show just what he was made of. And so this is with everybody. When we find the right place for ourselves, all this judging, whether you are good or bad, you know, ugly or healthy. I was telling some people that if any of you girls, you know, are fat, it's just you were born in the wrong time. Because if you look about 50, 100 years ago, I've seen all these old paintings, you know, in the national galleries, you know, of these really beautiful women, and they were already fat. You know, and so if you are just overweight, and just your timing was off. You should have been born 100 years ago, then you'd be hot. But you know, fat people are good as well, they're really good fun. So don't ever demean yourself and think, oh, I am ugly or I am not smart. No, everybody has incredibly beautiful parts to them. The trouble is that we always tend to receive criticism. And this is one of the reasons I'm asking each one of you to please be careful, especially the way you talk to your kids. To even just be mindful for one day of how many times you praise your children. And how many times you criticize them. Now, this is your children. And if you can keep some sort of record of that, you'll be shocked how many times you put your kids down and how rarely you actually praise them. And now you can understand why your kids misbehave. Because you think you love them, you don't express it. You think you're caring for them, but what they actually hear is they're never good enough. Never good enough at school, never good enough at life, never good enough looking after their room, always watching too much TV, spending too much time on video games, whatever it is, never good enough. And I noticed that some years ago I was on a bus coming back from, I think it was teaching at a school, coming back here, and just sitting behind two girls, maybe about 13 or 14, on their way back from school, best friends, and listening to what they were saying. I was overhearing them, sitting right behind them, and listening to their conversation. I wasn't so shocked because it reminded me of my school days. The conversation went something like, you've got flat breasts, you're never going to get a boyfriend, but you've got a big nose, you're not going to get one either. And it always came picking faults in one another, and these were the best friends. Do you remember that at school? Sometimes even your best friends are picking faults with you, let alone your enemies. So when that happens, people actually come out of school, they come out of, you know, the beginning part of their life, thinking there's something wrong with them, they're not good enough. And of course that is the old lack of self-esteem, and that is why people actually have failures in life, failures in relationships. It's also actually why we seek for relationships. As I mentioned in a talk recently, that's why people actually like to fall in love. At last is one person who doesn't criticize me, who loves me for who I am. Because when somebody says, I really love you unconditionally, darling, you're amazing, you're wonderful, you're incredible, I'm so lucky to be with you. For some people, that's the first time in their life they feel validated. What? I'm okay? It's an incredible gift. The unconditional love which a person gives you. But unfortunately, because it's a romantic love, it usually doesn't last that long. And that's a really downer afterwards. When at last you thought you were worth something and they reject you, that's one of the reasons why breakups can be just so devastating for people. But why can't we do that with one another, even though there's no sort of romantic or sexual relationship involved? Why can't we respect one another and show kindness to one another, and praise one another? And my goodness, that's what I keep trying to do at monasteries, and try to do at Buddhist societies, and try and do with each one of you. Always building you up and praising you. Thank you so much for coming here. Thank you so much for all the incredible, generous acts you've done in this world. Because you receive that praise, what does that do for you? It does feel that you are worth something. I got my other trick for those of you who come to give food at Bodhinyana Monastery. I always look at you and say, oh, thank you for coming, young woman. And they're in their 70s. And I do that. It's just simple psychology. What, you call me young woman? I'm coming again. Don't you like being called young when you're sort of 60 or something? They call young men when you're in the 40s and 50s. It's a simple thing of like praise and kindness. Yeah, well, maybe a bit lying, but you know, not that much. What's very nice about it is you're saying kind things to people. You know how much people lap that up when you say kind things to them? You should try that more often. It's amazing just what you get out of life by just being kind to people. You know, there was some time ago, one of our monks spent time in hospital. I think it was in Fremantle Hospital. And I asked him when he came out, it was only a small thing, I said, how did you enjoy, you know, what was it like in there? He said, I had a wonderful time, people were so kind. And they were just so nice to me, all the nurses. I said, well, you should actually write to somebody to thank them. And he wrote to the Minister of Health. You know, saying thank you for your hospital. And you know what happened? I think it was McGowan. Was it McGowan or Minister of Health? Anyway, Minister of Health sometime ago. He got this personal letter back. Not dictated to a secretary, not printed out on the top, but handwritten. So this monk, oh, thank you so much. I got your letter. That made my day. Thank you for enjoying just this wonderful health service. You know, signed the minister or something. I know. You complain about not having enough beds and send it to the minister. You don't even get a letter back from the undersecretary of the secretary of the secretary. You don't get anything back at all. But you do a letter of praise, and it's incredible what that opens up for you. And afterwards I said, why is that? It's because it's so rare. We're always criticizing, putting each other down. And what happens? We lack this self-esteem. Some of us get so low. That's all we ever get. When we grow up, That's a terrible world to live in. So yeah, maybe a few people are very unlucky enough to have parents who give you that 24 hours a day throughout your whole upbringing. But you don't do that to your kids, to your friends. Please do much more praise in this world. So people don't have this lack of self-esteem. They have courage. They feel, yeah, they can go into life and do things. They can try out relationships. Yeah, they don't work this time. It doesn't mean you're a failure. When I went to one of these big conferences in, is it Hayward Island, over in the Great Barrier Reef some time ago, I was talking to one of these really big sort of industrialists in Australia. And, you know, he was just chatting, and he was just telling me, he said, oh, we don't call it failure in my business anymore. We call it forward failing. So what a beautiful little way of talking about it. You don't fail in life. You do a business, it doesn't work out. You try a relationship, and it doesn't work out. You know, it's not failure. Don't call it failure. That lacks a positive part of it. Call it forward failing. And that just gives it that little positivity that you are learning something from this, you're growing, you're getting better at it. So it means the next time you're more likely to succeed in business, in relationships, meditation, whatever. It means that, you know, you get the confidence. You're going to have another go. And you keep on going. And that way you do succeed. And when you do succeed, it's incredible. What, me? I succeeded? What, actually somebody actually loves me? And they care for me? Me? I can give good talks. I'm good at work. My kids love me. Where's that me? I can do that. And then you start to open up and see, yeah, you have got this beautiful Buddha nature inside of you. You have this kindness and goodness inside of you. And it's opened up. With the mindfulness and the kindness, a little bit of praise, it's actually working. So it's just getting it started. Starting to open up the lotus of some of these people who have been closed for such a long time. And the outside has been just so wounded and so scarred. They don't think they're good enough. The other story which, you know, I don't know how many times you've heard this one, but it is great. It just fits in at this point. Because sometimes people only listen to one talk. They don't know what I said 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. That's always the story. I told this at a conference on mental health, you know, during the winter time last year. And that was over in the convention centre in Perth. And the person came up to me afterwards and said, she apologised to me. Because she said, when I first saw you coming into our conference, you know, please excuse the language, this is what she said. I thought, who is this wanker coming to our conference? And she came to apologize for thinking like that, because I made her laugh, I made her cry. What made her cry? These were clients, you know, who had been through mental health problems and were just, you know, trying to do something to improve the service for others. So the story which made her cry, you know, was, you know, my story of the trees and the forest. I often use this when people go to Bodhinyana Monastery or go to Jhana Grove, but, you know, you don't need to say it there, say it here as well. Well, if you go this weekend and go for a walk in the forest somewhere, please find a perfect tree for me. A tree which has got all of the branches equally spaced. Only green leaves, no yellow leaves, no brown leaves, and no leaves which have been eaten by the insects. Which is perfectly straight, not crooked or leaning to the left or the right. And with a bark which hasn't been damaged by the bushfires or by the winds and things hitting it. A bark without scars on it. And if you can find such a tree, you'll be the first in the world to find a tree in the natural forest. Because every tree, you look at them, they're all bent and crooked. They've all got branches which have fallen off. And that leaves the holes, you know, where the birds and other animals can nest. And if you look at the leaves, there's lots of yellow leaves and brown leaves and leaves which have been eaten by insects. And all the trees are crooked and bent. And the scars on their bark, they're just, the bark is really rough and knobbly and scarred. They're the beautiful trees. And I said in this talk, if you are one of those trees, all bent and crooked, with heaps of scars on the bark, with branches which have been ripped off, by the storms of your life. You belong as one of the beautiful trees in the forest. You're my favorites. Because certainly I like the crooked trees, the bent trees, with all the scars and the knobby bits on the outside. They're the ones which are beautiful. So if you're one of those scarred and damaged trees, don't let anyone say there's something wrong with you. In fact, if you're totally perfect without scars, you're not bent at all, there's something wrong with you now. You're unnatural. That doesn't exist. You're not beautiful. What that actually does, it takes people who have been through difficult times, and instead of looking at them as if they don't belong, they do belong. And their scars, bent and crooked, is what makes them beautiful. What they're doing is they're seeing beyond what other people see. They're seeing the beauty inside of them. They're opening up the lotus to see the Buddha nature inside of them. It's incredible when people do that. They blossom. You don't have to be like a supermodel or some footballer for the West Coast Eagles or the Dockers to be incredibly hot. All you need to do is to open your heart and see this beautiful kindness and joy and purity inside every human being. And then when you start to do that, what other people said about you just doesn't make any sense at all. You totally reject what other people say, because you can see inside of yourself what's really true. Whether your parents didn't love you, they rejected you, they beat you, they sexually abused you. That happens to so many people. That doesn't make you an ugly person. It's not that you don't belong. Yeah, you're bent, you're crooked, you're scarred. You're beautiful. And when you can start to see that, your lotus opens. You find you belong. All your lack of self-esteem, the feeling that you don't belong, that you're rejected, disappears. And then, all the other beautiful things in life, the relationships, the success, going to work, the joy, the happiness, the laughter, it all comes to you. You open up. A lot of times, because of fear, we close up, hurt so many times, we don't want to trust anybody. But you know, the only thing which opens you up is the kindness, the mindfulness. It opens you up enough to trust. There's lots of beautiful people out there. There's lots of dogs who've got unconditional love. If dogs have got that, how many human beings have got even more? When that starts to happen, people just soften, open, heal. And instead of causing harm to themselves and in this world, they don't go out trying to do good in this world. They just naturally do good. Kind, beautiful, happy people who just want to spend time with one another. Why? Just like a dog will come and run up to you and lick you, even though they don't even know who you are. And that's a beautiful kindness in our world. When you see that, it's there. We need more of it. We need it to be shown more and more. So please, never lose the opportunity. Never pass it by to be kind to someone, to say a beautiful word. Whether it's a bus driver who takes you to work in the morning, whether it's somebody stuck in the traffic, you can roll your window down, hi. Little acts of kindness. One of the hardest places to crack, for me anyway, is the London Underground. But I've succeeded many times. If you've ever gone to the London Underground, you're not allowed to look at each other. You've got to look down. And you've got your paper. And someone's looking at you. What do they want? Well, there's a mic you can do that. I remember just very easy. You're stuck in this underground. I don't know how long. And this is depressing. So I saw this girl. She was holding her baby. And I told her fib. I looked up and said, that's a beautiful baby. I don't like babies, but I said it's a beautiful baby. And that just opened this girl up. She said, oh, really? He said, who are you? Where are you from? Oh, you're from Australia. You're a monk. We had this beautiful conversation to the very end. Just a tiny little bit of kindness like that. And that's a wonderful way to open up to somebody. Say she's got a beautiful kid. Straight away, mothers love that. Straight away, you're their friend. So So little things like that, just amazing what you can do. Just, you know, just compliment somebody on some, a little bit of praise. It's just so rare that people actually open up, they accept it, and they just, you can change the whole journey that way. And that's actually how we can create a better world. And so there's many poor people, you know, like the person who asked me this question. It needs not just me, it needs each one of you to be kind, to praise one another, to say hello. Even a simple thing, just a smile. Smile at somebody. It doesn't matter if they don't smile back. You know, wear them down with your smiling. And after a while, that just people give in. And then they feel they're loved, they're cared for. Somebody smiled at me today. Wow. Made my whole day. And that's happened to me. I just smiled at somebody and just thought it was normal. They come back, you know, your smile made me so happy. Made me change the whole course of my day. Thank you. Simple things can do that. So you go out there and do that. So these people in this world who've had some incredible bad childhoods, haven't been loved by their parents, relationships never worked out, always been criticized at work and life and feel themselves a failure. You go out there and smile at them. Say hello to them. Be kind. A little bit of praise. It's so rare. It just melts them. You be the dog who licks them, metaphorically. And that don't do it literally. And that will actually change people's lives and make very lot of people, and maybe you as well listening here, who think you're not worth anything. You realise, yeah, you've been burnt, you know, you've been injured, but you are a beautiful tree. And most importantly, you belong. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okay, that was from the little person over in UK who asked me to talk about this. I hope it works. It's very sort of sad to hear that people, how people are treated. You've got some questions over there. Okay, these are the questions from overseas. Any questions from here? We can just deal them in a few moments. Here we go. First of all, from Malta, what do you suggest for someone who suffers severe low self-confidence as a result of bullying in childhood and at work? I can give you this one is from Malta. You keep tuning in from here, Christine from Malta, and your self-confidence will grow and grow and grow and grow because you'll be receiving a lot of praise and a lot of see if you can find yourself a nice little dog over in Malta. And the dog teaches you that, yeah, actually you are wonderful, you're a great person. And from the dog meditation, you can go out to people meditation. And, you know, people get bullied. One of the troubles with bullying, I gave a talk on bullying some years ago, is the hierarchies we have. Whenever there's hierarchies, you know, people in high positions, the bosses at work, there's always going to be the bullying. It's like, you know, in schoolyards, if you have kids in the same schoolyard of vastly different ages and different physical prowess, of course there's going to be bullying sometimes. So the hierarchies is one of the reasons why there's bullying. So if you can, bullying in childhood, you know, that's gone now. But at work, please find a nice place of work. There's many good places of work. And people who bully you at work, I mean, that's not good for the company, not good for you. And just don't take what they say seriously, in one ear and out the other. And find some really nice friends. And you practice, you know, this is even though that you're a victim. And I was saying today, there's only two letters different between being a victim and a victor. You know, so turn it around to be a victor. But just you go around praising people at work. You go around being kind at work. And if you try and do that, you change the whole work scene. When you're kind to them, you get kindness back. Anyway, another one from Uruguay. Is there anything one can do when other people don't see there's beauty in every person? Yeah, you be a beautiful person. You be such a kind person. And they see the beauty in you. And then when you go and see other people, you see beauty in them. When you can see beauty in another person, then they start to see it in themselves. Again, that's what I did when I went to prisons where people tend not to see beauty in themselves. Because they're, you know, in Australia, they wear green clothes, and everyone else wears other types of clothes, but when you're in jail, you wear green clothes. And some prisons in the United States who wear orange clothes. Everything keeps telling you you're a prisoner. And you've done something wrong. And every that time, every time of the day, you're reminded that, you know, of your crime. Nothing reminds you of the other part of yourself. So that's when you need people like myself to go inside a prison and say, yeah, you're not a criminal. You're a person who's done a crime. I see the other part of themselves, other part of them. And the thing is, when I see that beautiful part of them, they see it in themselves. So Caroline from Uruguay, you go around seeing the beauty in other people. That's your training. And just because you see it, they will start to see it themselves. And lastly, from Perth. It may be someone sitting in here, because sometimes people said we didn't have a chance to ask a question because you only answer questions from overseas. So actually sitting over there, they got on their phone and they wrote a question. Okay, how does the Buddhist philosophy deal with the concept of the clinical psychopath? I believe that these people are worthy of empathy as they are only hardwired in a different way. However, they exert a large influence over society at large, but due to their nature, does the lotus exist within this personality type? Of course it does. Clinical psychopath, be careful of what the clinical system diagnoses and stereotypes people as. If you label a person as a psychopath, they become a psychopath. They live up to your expectations. And there's no such thing, as far as I understand the nature of the human mind in Buddhism, there's no such thing as a psychopath. There's a person who exhibits psychopathic tendencies. And it's not hardwired, there's much more to the human being than the brain. And don't think there's something wrong with the brain, that's why they do these things. Otherwise you give them all of these chemicals, you know, to try and change their brain chemistry. Or, you know, take out part of their brain with surgery and stuff like that, thinking that's going to help. It's not just the brain. It's this mind thing as well. And if you can get into the mind stuff, then there's another whole area of treatment. So, you know, with a clinical psychopath, there's no such thing. Unfortunately, you have to diagnose these things, and that's a really unfortunate part of our society. So a person who's exhibited psychopathic tendencies. But then, is there another way to deal with that? Can just a person who has no empathy learn empathy? And of course, one of the great examples I was talking about, these kids, you know, who were, I don't know what they were diagnosed as, but were probably diagnosed as hopeless cases, and they just learned some empathy themselves, you know, from little animals. Maybe it's because animals were safe. People had hurt them so many times that they would not open up towards the kindness of a human being. But a little kitten or a little puppy just melted their defenses, opened them out. So I'd actually get a psychopath a little puppy. And even if it killed it, I'd get him another puppy. So many puppies until the puppy broke the psychopath down. That's probably what I would do. They exert a large influence over society at large. It's because we're afraid of them. We don't know how to deal with them. So eventually we just institutionalize them. But how many psychopaths who were supposed to be psychopaths actually do change and do learn? I'm sure there's been quite a few who actually open themselves up to kindness. It's just the conditioned nature of the mind. To be conditioned to be afraid, conditioned, you know, to hide the empathy. You know, I don't know, for a long time I said this story. I remember as a young monk, I had this dream once. It was a very powerful dream, which I remember it so well. And I remember just dreaming that I was being tortured. I don't know if this was a past life, but it was very vivid. Being tortured by people stabbing me, and it hurt so much that I went to a deep place inside myself just to escape the pain. It's the only place I could find. And it's a quite strange dream, because I dreamt I was catatonic for years, alive but not being able to respond, like in a coma. And what took me out was just these beautiful kind words, you know, from a carer in some institution somewhere, who was so kind that I trusted the world again. and allowed myself to be drawn out back into life. It's a weird dream, but what it actually showed me was the way that we hide because of the great pain of life. Sometimes it gets so painful, either physically or emotionally, but if you cannot take any more, we go into some sort of hiding place. You know, for me in that dream was just in a deep, deep catatonia where I would not respond to anything in the world. Or it could be just with, you know, the other protective mechanisms of unwilling to show any empathy and being violent, used to protect yourself. And the only way out was incredible kindness, which, you know, to me, and also in Buddhist ideas, is the power which nothing can resist. Incredible kindness, just drawing you out from a place, a hiding place built by fear, coming out into the world again, being alive again. It's only a dream, but it was very meaningful for me. And this is the psychopath. They are in their little bunker inside themselves. That's the only way they know to protect themselves. They've been hurt really badly. So badly you can't stand it anymore, literally. And you go inside. And the kindness just draws you. Becomes irresistible. Draws you out back into the world again. It's kindness, compassion. That is what draws the psychopath out. Yeah, they're beautiful inside. The kindness needs to open that door. Okay. Any questions from the floor here? Yes, over there. We'll just have one question because otherwise we go over time.
You said earlier in the talk that there's no need for self-improvement.
Yeah.
And my first question is this. Isn't self-improvement just about growth? And isn't growth just what we are doing right now, about learning meditation, coming to talks like this?
Yeah.
And my second question is that how do we reconcile growth and being content?
Exactly. It's when you're content, only then do you grow. And this is the same thing with self-improvement. If you try to improve yourself, you tend to get worse. We've been trying to do that for years, trying to improve society, trying to improve the economy, trying to improve. And a lot of times there's something psychologically wrong with that. And I don't know if you've got a partner in life, but please never, if you've got a nice partner, boyfriend or a husband, please don't try to improve him. If you try and improve him, you'll destroy your relationship. It's not about improving the person you stay with, it's by caring for him. And when you care for him, then he improves. Then he grows. Just like you. If someone cared for you, really cared for you, you'd blossom. You'd grow. To grow a flower, you don't need to stretch it. You just need to care for it. The warmth of the sun. You've got enough water in the ground, enough nutrients there. It just needs the sun to actually turn those nutrients in the soil and the water into this beautiful flower or tree, whatever it is. That's how things grow. From kindness. You know, sometimes I was talking with someone earlier about regenerating parts of the forest. The best way to regenerate part of the forest is just to fence it and keep people out. Keep people from trying to improve it. And it grows naturally. It improves naturally. It's the nature of this world to do that. If we can only leave it alone. If someone could only leave you alone, instead of always trying to get you to change this and improve this and learn that, they could just leave you alone. You would grow naturally and beautifully to a great human being. And they try to improve you. And that sucks. And look, you've heard me teach meditation. If you try and improve your meditation, it gets worse. If you care for it, just let it be. Well, you get enlightened. This is a powerful psychology of Buddhism. And all this improvement. What are you trying to improve to? What is this goal you're trying to reach? You know, the perfect woman. The perfect man with all of these attainments and whatever, little pieces of paper you can put on the wall of your office, a degree here, a PhD there, another certificate in this, another certificate in that. All that ever does is destroy the trees in the world with all this paper and stuff. And that's not who you are either. It just means you're good at exams. You know the system. You know, you can actually get qualifications here. It doesn't make you a good psychiatrist or a good doctor or a good person. So caring, not curing. You know that old story, doctors. Doctor's job is to care, not to cure. Not to improve, but to care for the patient, and then the improvement happens. Be careful there. There's something very powerful and deep in that teaching. We always want to improve other people. We always want to improve ourselves. And we get in a big mess all the time. Care for yourself. Care for your partner. Care for life. Care for the planet. Then it cures. Okay, enough for this evening. Thank you very much, everybody. And now I'm going to pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And then afterwards, have a chat, whatever you need to do.